Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00016. Recorded on February 6, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. One Monday at a Time. Chapter 16.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
It is a Monday. I, like so many other people in this world, do not like Mondays. Now, not everybody has an actual reason or right to complain about the fact of Monday and how much it sucks. There's a relationship between the suckage of Monday and the fact of starting a new work week, right? That's the basic problem with Mondays. By and large, society as a whole has Saturdays and Sundays off. That is the standard. But again, it's not 100% the case. Some people might have Sundays and Mondays. Some people might have just Mondays off. It might be a good day for a lot of people. Hey, it's Monday, right? Not me. Not me and not most of humanity, right? I don't like Mondays because it's the beginning of a work week. That means you got 5 days of the drudgery of the job, if you have a shitty job like I do, of the commute, like almost everybody's got a shitty commute one way, shape, or form. And that's coming and going, so twice a day. Your days are just filled with the shit that comes along with your job, right? Where the weekends ain't no job and all that shit's gone, right? They're much better days. I love Saturdays and I love Sundays and I love Friday nights. I don't like Mondays. And that's a song, right? We older people know, you know, we Generation X's and the fucking baby boomers, you know. Before us, we're very familiar with the Boomtown Rats song, right? Bob Geldof, the guy who played Pink in the Pink Floyd The Wall movie and became some kind of philanthropical save the world rock and roll dude, which I always find nauseating. I don't know why. You know, I've got a heart and compassion for people. It ain't like I don't. I don't like these rock stars that get all wrapped up in that shit. But no, that's their thing. You know, let it be so. Not for me to decide one way or another how people should conduct themselves. That's between them, God, and the devil, ultimately, right? Like it is for me, like it is for you, whether you like it or not. But, yeah, they made a song, Boomtown Rats. They're UK. They're Irish? I'm not sure, Irish or English or something like that. Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Mondays, a 1979 song. So I was in junior high, and we would hear it, you know, like on a school bus, whoever the driver was, we'd be playing the radio. And the song was kind of common and popular, you know. Well, we all knew it. We all knew it at the time. Nobody knew the Boomtown Rats, but everybody knew that song. And it was a good song. You know, there was a certain feeling to it. Unfortunately, the events surrounding the story of the lyrics in the song, not so good. It was a school shooting, as it turns out, right? A school shooting in 1979 that occurred somewhere in San Diego, California, where some 16-year-old, some teenage girl, right, which does not really fit the profile in this day and age, but it was a 16-year-old girl who lived across the street from, I think it was an elementary school, went in there and just shot the place up. I don't know all the details of it, but it was something to that effect. I was out in San Diego. It was very, you know, being a song about that, it's very close kin to something people will probably be more familiar with. It's not quite as old. You're still going back 32 years or something with Pearl Jam, right? Pearl Jam, Jeremy, the song Jeremy. Now, here is a DFW reference right here. A lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people around here don't realize it, but that song is about a kid in Richardson High, right? Richardson, literally, like, you know, I could probably piss on the road out front of here where I work, and it would probably roll downhill along the curb and end up in Richardson eventually, right? Richardson is basically, I mean, the furthest northeastern corner of Richardson. I actually got baptized there, right? When I became a Protestant Christian, I was baptized in a pool in a yard in a neighborhood right there, right? It's kind of this intersection where Murphy, Texas, and Richardson come together. Garland not too far down the street, and Wiley just down the street the other way. You know, it's like kind of four towns kind of come together right there, right? With Plano just down the street the other way. So just there's a lot of like towns kind of converge right there. But one of those towns is Richardson. It's like, what the fuck is it? 3 miles down the street from where I'm sitting right now? It's not far at all. It's one of the border towns of Dallas, right? Most of it is Dallas County, if not all. There's probably a little corner of it that's technically in Collin County. That's the way it is in Texas, right? Texas towns, cities are not confined necessarily by the counties, right? You could bleed over county lines if you keep on annexing territory. And that's what happens around here. For example, when I lived in Dallas, I lived in a little section of Dallas that was actually in Collin County, not in Dallas County, right? That's the way it goes. So I think Richardson's probably got a little corner like that. In fact, the corner where I got baptized probably is like that, but I am not 100% positive exactly how that plays out. But yeah, Pearl Jam's Jeremy happened, right? It was a kid who went into school and he shot himself in class in front of everybody, right? Committed suicide. And, yeah, right here at DFW, right down the street. That sort of thing happens, you know? Obviously, going back to 1979, people say, oh, there was no such thing as, like, school shootings until, like, Columbine. No, actually, 79, there was a school shooting. And, you know, what Jeremy did, and I don't know, it must have been early 90s, maybe late 80s, when the Jeremy story happened. It's a school shooting. It wasn't it wasn't homicide, it was suicide, but it was a shooting that occurred in a school, right? And that's a good 10 years before Columbine happened. What I'm trying to get to is not the fact that school shootings kind of go back. Yes, they're way more prevalent now than they ever have been, and it sucks and it's fucked up. But these incidents, we had an incident in our high school. We had some kid, he was a friend of somebody who I partied with, right? And he had graduated high school, and he comes back. He showed up with some kind of shotgun or rifle. And, like, he walked into the, I don't know exactly how the story went, but nothing happened. He never pulled the trigger, never pointed at anybody. As the story goes, he was suicidal. He was going to kill himself. But he showed up as a high school graduate to the high school wanting to talk to his friend, you know, or he was going to kill himself. fucking weird. But weird shit happens. Because why? Because the teenage years are a very strange time in the lives of people, you know? The transition between childhood and adulthood is, to use the very common descriptor for it, awkward. It's just awkward. You know, most kids are physically awkward. They grow tall before they fill out, so they end up being lanky and bony, and, you know, they don't have the muscle structure to support the bone structure. The bone structure, like, hasn't really, like, fully formed. It's all fucked up. You know, physically, we're fucked up. And then part of that is hormonally. Like, the girls are fucked up hormonally because they go through all kinds of changes. Guys are doing it too, but it's not as dramatic hormonally. But, you know, it shows up in things like acne, for example, right? Obviously, being lanky and weird of built and things like that. It's a very difficult time for every single one of us, you know. We all have got our challenges as we go through that part of life. And, you know, some people kind of just lose their shit. I was like that. I was suicidal. I could easily see me being the person to go into the school to kill myself or others, you know. That it didn't happen is kind of miraculous. But that sort of shit, you know, because it didn't happen, may pad the stats a little bit. But, you know, through the 80s, people were fucking nuts. In the 70s, people were nuts. People are always fucking nuts. It's just, you know, how they deal with it, how they express it. The school shootings became a thing, you know. The Columbine was like the granddaddy of them all. And what was the deal? You had kids that were, what, picked on? Who didn't fit in? It was basically staged a rebellion, right? And they took it out at school because school was their life. And it was also their nemesis. It's sad shit. It's sad shit. But yeah, you know, Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Mondays, and also Pearl Jam's Jeremy, both, you know, on that line of kids not able to deal and going to school to doing something fucking murderous and you know, stupid, you know, stupid for sure. And other songs about Monday too. I mean, you know, Monday is not just a day for going to school and shooting people up, you know. Like I said earlier, it's more on the lines of, fuck, the weekend is over, and now we've got to go to work, you know? We've got to commute, we've got to do all this shit, you know? The fun is over, the party's over. I think we tend to feel more productive when we get things done at home than we do on our job. It depends on your job. I guess that's just person to person, you know? Me, my job is fruitless. You know, somebody just this morning walked in the door and saw me doing my job and said, that there looks like a thankless job, and just walked away. Oh, well, I don't know what the fuck I'm supposed to do with that. Okay, Captain Obvious, or thank you for bringing me down, or whatever, you know? So fucking keep your words to yourself. Shut that pie hole and just move along. Take care of your business. Get the fuck out of here. But, you know, but that's it. Monday is the job, the new week, the new work week, and, you know, having to piss away our time doing things that we don't necessarily want to be doing when there's so much else better to be doing, right? And life is short. You know, life is short. And so, you know, we just got to make that money. So what? Another song, I don't want to get into it, the 80s, Working for the Weekend. Everybody's working for the weekend. You know, of course, and it sucks. Other Monday song, you know, real dreary. I remember this one from, I guess, early 70s when I was a kid in Hillside, New Jersey. You know, I still remember shit from being that age, like second grade, you know, first grade. I remember literally, like, I guess I was home from school in the summertime and it was a rainy day and having my face in the window and my mother's playing a radio in the house and this song, you know, rainy days and Mondays always. It was like a fucking Monday and it was raining. You know, it was just, I could have been the video for the song, you know. And, but I remember, you know, I remember that stupid moment in my life. It was the Carpenters, right? It was a brother and sister. The guy played the drums and Karen Carpenter was the anorexic woman who died from that. Body image, identity issue, I guess is what you call that sort of thing. Sadly, one of the greatest voices you'll ever hear, one of the most unique voices you'll ever hear, you know, very powerful. And I was never a great fan or anything like that, but I know great when I hear great. And that was, you know, that was a great voice. Other Monday. Ba-da, that's the Mamas and the Papas, right? The hippie era. 1965, 66, somewhere in there. They did the Monday, Monday song. One of the most... when I hear that song, they sound bored. Like, it's a song that they don't even like. They're just doing, you know? It's just... there's something boring about that tune. There's a little bridge part that kind of kicks it up a notch, but it all ends up falling flat dead again. And just because Mondays suck. And it's really an adequate expression, you know? If you've got a song about Monday and it's kind of really boring and it falls flat, yeah, because that's fucking Monday, right? Mamas and the Papas. Now, Mamas and the Papas, I got, like, really mixed feelings about the Mamas and the Papas. I probably should take a minute and sort them all out before I open my mouth, right? But musically, right? Musically, what they were, they were a folk group, right? So it was like folk music from New York City, basically. The whole Greenwich Village scene in New York in the early 60s with the Beatniks and all that shit, right? Columbia University, Greenwich Village, Soho, Washington Square Park. That's where I used to go when I used to go to New York, right? It was a lot different when I went there, but in the early 60s, you know, the folk music was the scene there. I mean, a bunch of communists and shit, you know, hanging out, making music. And, it was not the most commercial music of the time. People made their money singing in those small bars, the coffee shops and shit like that. No, but as far as their albums going out, they weren't, you know, killing it, making money. Then the whole British invasion wave came in, you know, with the Beatles and the Beatlemania and all that. I'm not a Beatles fan. I'm not. I was periodically early in my teenage year, you know, my quote-unquote hippie year, I guess when I was like part of my freshman year, part of my sophomore year. It was about a year's worth of time, you know, when I was into all the Peace Pop, Microdot shit, and, you know, Beatles kind of fell in line with that. And, yeah, I didn't like them up to that point, and after that point, I didn't like them again. And I saw the Imagine movie about John Lennon when it came out. My wife, my first wife from my early 20s, I think we were dating when it came out. We went down to the old movie theater. Shit, I don't even know if it stands anymore. It was on Easton Avenue in Somerset, and a movie theater over there by the old, a Kmart, right? JFK Boulevard and Easton Avenue in the corner over there. We saw Imagine. There's a movie, I guess, that Yoko Ono did or was heavily involved in, and it was documentary-like with, like, home movie footage. And, you know, at like that point, I was kind of indifferent about the Beatles and John Lennon. I mean, speaking of boring songs, there ain't no more boring song on fucking earth than Imagine by John Lennon. I can't stand that fucking song. I cannot stand that song on so many levels. But musically, oh my God, it makes me want to put a bullet through my head. You know, me and Jeremy, you know, fucking A. I hate that song. But after this movie, Imagine, I came to hate John Lennon. I don't know what that movie was trying to convey, but my wife and I both, we walked out of there like, that dude's a scumbag. Fuck him, you know? And my attitude has never changed since then, you know? only more details have come in along the way to kind of fill it out. He wasn't all his promoters made him out to be, I guess you might say. Who is, right? Who is? Fame is a fucked up, funny fucking thing. But anyway, yeah, the Beatles invasion came in, and it had an impact, you know, such a cultural impact, actually a better word for it is such a commercial impact, right, that these folk players in Greenwich Village started getting the idea in their head of, like, instead of doing what they're doing, you know, carrying on that traditional, the tradition of folk music and all the harmonies, the 2, the 3, the 4-part harmonies that really made that something, you know. Of course, all the stories that had the hidden meanings about politics and shit in it and everything like that. That's what the folk music was about. They kind of took what they had and they kind of melded it with this Beatlemania stuff. And the Mamas and the Papas are like one of the originals to do that. The other one, the Byrds, right? B-Y-R-D-S, Byrds. Thank you, because it's so cool to have fucking Y's in a word instead of I's and shit, right? Leonard Skinner, who I do like. You know? And if you know me and you know my last name, I got Y's like that too. That it doesn't make me cool, it don't make you cool either. It just doesn't work that way. But anyway... fucking A. Mamas and the Papas, they like the Byrds in the like late early 60s, mid 60s, like 64, 65. They were making this transition out of folk music into like some kind of cheap replicant of the Beatles, right? Like an American version of the Beatles. And then you had a bunch of shit that went like that. The Monkees, right, with the TV show, they became something like that. They were more of a created entity. They, you know, they weren't whatever they were, and then they became like the Beatles. They were actually manufactured. That's the word I'm looking for. They were a manufactured pop band built on the lines of the Beatles, right? The haircuts, the styles, the sunglasses, shit, even on fucking, because I brought up Star Trek a few chapters back here, right, the Enterprise, I was talking about Star Trek, this I read along the way, or I saw a video, I heard it, something like that, the character, the Russian guy on the original series, the young guy, Chekhov, right, every time they say his name, both me and my wife look at each other, did they just call him a jerk off, right, and I know you know what I mean, it always sounds like that, but Chekhov, right, the young Russian guy, like the teenage Russian guy who gets brought in, I think in the second season, he was brought in with the intent to appear like the Beatles. They wanted somebody young with a Beatles haircut to come in and be on that show. This would be like 1967, I guess, right? A little late, you know, a little late in the game, but that's what they wanted, to like draw young people and younger people into it. So they brought this teenager that looked like you know, like Paul McCartney with the fucking bowl cut hair. Like, I mean, my brother had to wear when we were little kids too, because we were so fucking styling, right? That whole Beatlemania kind of bled over to all kinds of stuff like that. It wasn't just the music, but it, you know, I'm talking about the music right now. So you had, you know, going back, the Monkees, the Byrds, and then ultimately the Mamas and the Papas, they were all like doing that. They're all wearing like these Indian caftans and, you know, it's just fucking weird hippie shit ultimately. I mean, looking back, oh my god. See, now like going back to the Mamas and the Papas, I kind of got like these mixed emotions about it. The music that they did, right, I just explained to you what that music was. A combination of folk and some kind of like first wave of British invasion amalgamation, right? And they got their sound like that. So the folk element that they brought into it was like they had 4 singers, 2 male, 2 female. That's the Mamas and the Papas, right? They did a 4-part harmony that was so sonic and it just sounded so good. They had so many songs that had such terrible fucking lyrics to them. but it always just sounded really great because of the voicing, right? And so I like to listen to the Mamas and the Papas. It just kind of like puts a good atmosphere into my mood, right? If that's not redundant, you know, mood is kind of an atmosphere inside the skull, but it gives me a good feeling, right? It's good feeling music, regardless of whatever the lyrics may be, with probably the exception of Monday Monday, which just makes me want to fall on my face and bash my head, you know? But here we go. We're about Monday and music. Yeah, it's not their only song. It's not their most famous song. California Dreamin' is their most famous song. And that's one of, like, two that I really like. Like, California Dreamin' I liked when I was a teenager. It was like the one Mamas and the Papas song that I was into. That if it came on the radio, I'd tell all my friends to shut the fuck up and let me listen to it. You know, that sort of thing. And I'm like, hey, dude, it's the Mamas and the Papas. I love that song. Well, not so much now as I did then. You know, I've kind of wore it out. But it's one of two songs that they did that I'm aware of that have this kind of storyline of leaving the dreariness of New York City, going out to the sunshine of Los Angeles, right? California Dreamin's one of them. If you know the lyrics to it, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't know, go look it up, because I'm not going to lay them out right here. But that premise is in that song. And that was their big breakthrough song, by the way. That song came out and made them, like, totally fucking famous. I think that was 65, right? And it was kind of on, like, it was kind of connected to the tail end of that whole, like, big surf rock craze that happened early on. Dick Dale and the Ventures and early Beach Boys music and others, you know, plenty of others. There was a whole genre, a whole realm of all that surf rock, which I like. I like that music. I consider that part of Americana for sure, you know, absolutely. It's the far west end of Route 66, right? So anyway, California Dreamin' kind of hitchhiked onto that. The prominence of Southern California in the early 60s as a quote-unquote cultural scene for young people now incorporated this hippie faction that was starting to blossom in Los Angeles, right? With groups like the Byrds and the Mamas and the Papas. I mentioned about the Monkees, right? The other song that the Mamas and the Papas had that was similar in context is called 1230, right? There was a clock in New York City outside their apartment that was broken. It always said 1230, you know, on some bell tower or some shit like that. So that's what the 1230 is. And it talked about the dreariness in New York City. And then it talked about, like, the other side of their life when they get to L.A. and how life is out there, right? And they're talking about young girls are walking through the canyon or something like that, right? So it's about all these young girls, right? Which is kind of creepy. And I'll get into the creepiness of that in a moment. But they're talking about the Laurel Canyon, right? Laurel Canyon, which is Hollywood Hills, just, you know, Laurel Canyon Boulevard goes, you know, straight through the Hollywood Hills out to, like, Studio City, where they used to film all the fucking porn and shit in the 70s and 80s, and maybe still do, I don't know. You know, you had Hollywood with the movies, and you had Studio City and the Valley with the porn, and in between you had, like a forested mountain range, you know, it was with a bunch of houses, and Laurel Canyon had the houses kind of like lumped up on top of each other real close to the road, and it turned out that it was a haven for young entertainers, and it had been for a long time, right? More typically, it was Hollywood actors that lived there in days of yore, in the golden age of Hollywood and shit, but in the 60s, all of a sudden you started to have this hippie rock and roll, not really rock and roll, hippie rock, the, well, the was the folk rock is what it was called, the Mamas and the Papas and the Birds and shit like that. And then it kind of became the psychedelic rock, right? It all kind of molded into that, and it became like this whole hippie, the music and sounds of the hippie generation of the 60s, right? And it all emulated out of this neighborhood, or this section, this area of Hollywood, Los Angeles, called Laurel Canyon, right? Laurel Canyon. So 1230 is that song by the Mamas and the Papas that actually makes reference to that canyon, and people kind of trekking up through there to do what? Party with who? All the rich and famous young entertainers, actors, musicians, shit like, and they would just all kind of like hang out, flop at each other's house, do drugs, have open wild sex, and jam, you know. You had bands like the Birds and Buffalo Springfield and shit. They would break up and reform into something else. And it just kind of, and that's why it was kind of similar to like the grunge era Seattle scene, right? Yeah, just a certain amount of really prominent grunge era rock musicians that hung out together and did shit all the time, and they kind of mixed and matched until they finally had a band that kind of clicked and got famous and made money, right? So that scene was kind of a replication of what was going on in Laurel Canyon in the 60s with the musicians over there. And I was familiar with it, you know, I was familiar with it. I was a big Doors fan when I was in junior high, and going into maybe my freshman year of high school, and started to fade away after that. But I was a huge fan of, you know, Jim Morrison and the Doors, and I know that they all lived up there during that time, right? They formed a band in 66, and they started producing records in 67 and got famous really quick, and they were living amongst other places around Los Angeles at that time. They was in the Laurel Canyon, right? Now down at the bottom of the canyon, they have some kind of, what was it, like a general store or some shit like that, and behind it was some kind of building that had apartments, and Jim Morrison and his woman were shacked up there. And then, you know, up the road somewhere, up Laurel Canyon Boulevard and off one of the side streets, two of the Doors, I think, shared a house for a while, and something like that. But they like all lived and hung out in there. And the, I remember you know, I spent time in California when I was in the Marine Corps. I don't know if you all know, but I was in the Marine Corps, and in 1987 I was stationed at Camp Pendleton, and I got four, and that's down what the hell is that, North County. It's north of San Diego and south of LA. It's in the middle there, like San Clemente and Oceanside. It's between those two cities. I used to go down to Oceanside all the time. I've got stories about that. But this one particular weekend, right, I managed to snake my way out of like weekend duties, and it was Thanksgiving, as it was, right, Thanksgiving weekend. I got a 4-day leave, right, 4-day liberty to get away from all the Soldier Boy bullshit. And a buddy of mine from Connecticut, he finagled the same thing. So we took off. We hopped on a, we went on a bus, right? We found out like the Greyhound bus, and we went up to L.A. without a plan. We just kind of showed up there, right? There's a whole story with that. And if I tell the whole story, it gets fucked up, right? It takes a lot of time. And I want to kind of bypass that and just get to the whole Laurel Canyon part of it, which is really anti-part. You'll see what I'm saying in a second. We ended up in Hollywood, right? We ended up getting up to Hollywood, and we're just walking around. We checked into a hotel. I guess it's a hotel. It was a Holiday Inn, right there. I don't know if it's still there. There was a Holiday Inn right on Sunset Boulevard. No, Hollywood Boulevard, right? Right on Hollywood Boulevard. And it was kind of tall, big old hotel, and we managed to get a room in there. So we camped out there for four-day weekend. And we, you know, hit the streets, and we're looking at, like, we're going into bars and shit. And somewhere along the way, we run into this guy, right? He had a stretch limo van. It wasn't like humongous, like some of the ones you see now that are like three blocks long. It was minimally stretched. It was longer than a normal van, but it was not ridiculous. This guy had put it together, and he was trying to start a business. and he wanted to, well, he was a limo driver. He wanted to, like, find military people and shit like that who would pay money for a day or a weekend to just be driven around. And it was cool. He had a full bar set up in there. He charged us $100 each, and he was basically our tour guide for Los Angeles for 4 days. And he kept the liquor the bar stocked, drove us wherever we asked to go. I mean, we were going to bars, to whorehouses. I had all these kind of places like I wanted to go and see. And then when I got there, I was like, because I was a Doors fan, I wanted to go to the Whiskey A Go-Go, right, the club they have there. We pull up there, and it's all, you know, hairband metalheads, like in a line around the block to get in. And I did the math really quick, and I was like, you know what? This is not what I'm here for. I don't want to go hang out with that shit, you know? And I could just see it. Yeah, I wanted to go to, like, the Hard Rock Cafe in Hollywood, and over there it was all Biff and Buffy, you know, Porsches, BMWs, you know, the suntan, the slick, like all the surfer spoiled brats were, and I'm not going in there either, right? It's, you know, all we did basically was go and get drunk and go to, like, the massage parlors and shit, you know, ultimately. But I wanted to go to Laurel Canyon, and the guy wouldn't even take us there. He was like, nah, we're not going up there. Why? Nah, this is, it's too weird. It's too much fucking trouble. I don't want to go up there. So I never got to, like, go up and see it with my own eyes. That's the way it was. Now, you know, only a few years prior, they had those Wonderland murders, right? Which I don't know the whole story. It involved drugs and shit like that and all kinds of other weird stuff. There's all kinds of weird stuff. In fact, there was this whole series, like on the internet, right? The internet series, what was it? It became a book, right? This guy, Dave McGowan was his name. He did this story of, it's sort of like podcast, right? And, the story, he had it written out, and he did a lot of interviews, which you could see on YouTube even still. Dave McGowan, McGowan, for those who are going to look it up. Kind of interesting subject matter. This particular angle involving what he called weird scenes inside the canyon was the shit that happened in Laurel Canyon over the years, right? And his take on it, his thesis on all of it, his ideas about what may have really been going on behind the scenes. And yeah, he called it Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, which is actually a take on a Doors song, which also... It was lyrics in a Doors song that actually became the name of a collection, anthology album, which if you're not a Doors fan, but you want to check it out, that's the album to get, Weird Scenes Inside the Gold Mine. It's a double album of, like, greatest hits and then some other, like, B-side shit thrown in. It's a good collection of the Doors stuff. That was always my favorite Doors album when I was a fan, right? Weird Scenes Inside the Gold Mine. That came from the song. What was the song? I think it was The End, right? 1967 on their original album. The long song The End makes reference to Weird Scenes Inside the Gold Mine. So Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon was a twist on those words, because the Doors were a part of that Laurel Canyon scene, as were so many fucking bands. More than I've already mentioned a handful of them, but there were so many more. And that situation really lasted for, like, a good solid 10 years. It went into the, you know, from the folk rock through the psychedelic hippie shit into the country rock, right? A lot of these old folk rock guys started to wear cowboy hats and get into folk music, which brings you up into, like, Poco and the Eagles, shit like that. That kind of music. I call it shit. I like that music, actually. I follow the guy, one of the original Poco guys on Facebook. Richie Furay, if that's how you say his name right. My favorite Poco song is one of his songs that he did early on, like on one of the first or second albums that they did. Never was a big Poco fan, but lately I kind of picked it up. The country rock is great. It's a great line of music. There's just a lot of really cool stuff in there. I looked at the Birds, right? The Birds kind of went that direction. They went away from the folk rock and away from the psychedelic shit and away from all the Beatlemania. And, you know, next thing you know, they're wearing cowboy hats and they're carrying handguns around and pretending to be cowboys and making country rock albums. That was, you know, good music, really good music. I like that style of music. It's a good genre, you know. And then the Eagles ended up, like, taking that up. And, you know, the closer they got to the 80s, the more away from the country feel they also got. But, yeah, it is what it is. Time has a way, right? There was this Dave McGowan talking about all these bands that were happening during that period of time. And his take on it was that the CIA was involved with putting that together. And the reason he uses to substantiate that notion is because so many of the musicians that were involved in these bands at that time had ties to military intelligence, right? Military intelligence is intelligence, like central intelligence, and they're kissing cousins. And, you know, there was something military / CIA about what was going on in Laurel Canyon in the mid-60s to the mid-70s, possibly beyond that. And his idea was the intelligence agencies were manufacturing controlled opposition to the war. Their big idea was to get into Vietnam and make money, do the things that these intelligence agencies do during war. And, you know, you had the big issues between the CIA and JFK and the great likelihood that the CIA actually arranged for the assassination. And, you know, they were at odds. It's a well-known fact. JFK and the CIA were at tremendous odds. And, you know, JFK wanted to de-escalate and not be involved with Vietnam, where the military-industrial complex, which involves intelligence and defense spending, they wanted in that war in a big way. And this is not me telling you. This is the history that was going on right up until this point in time. And what you started to have, and this is okay, this is going back to Dave McGowan telling his story. Now I'm trying to tell it for him, to you. He's dead now. He died of cancer a couple of years ago, apparently. So there's no more new stuff coming out from him. This animosity extended into the universities, right? I talked about the folk movement and the involvement with political ideology and the lyrics of folk songs. The audience for folk music was collegiate. And they had all kinds of meetings and demonstrations on college campuses. And you started to have the early fomentation of the anti-war movement of the 60s, right? The anti-Vietnam War movement. Originally, it was a college phenomenon. And what the intelligence agencies did, according to Dave McGowan, was to basically usurp that movement by developing this counterculture, these hippies, and then kind of denigrating the idea of the anti-war. They're taking the dredges of society, the snowflakes and the butterflies, the drug addicts, all the problem, runaway kids and everything like that. And you're making this, like, really way out there, fancy-pantsy, pansy-ass social collective that would become emblematic of the anti-war movement, right? So at that point in time in history, who the hell would want to be involved with that? And of course, it was not as big of a thing as people make it out to be. I remember having conversations with one of my ex's mothers who was of that age at that time in college and all that. And I asked her, you know, what was it like to be in Texas, San Antonio as it was, you know, going to college with all this hippie stuff going. It didn't exist in her realm. It wasn't there. No different than like right now we have all this Antifa stuff going on. And you would, you know, to watch TV, which I don't, but, you know, you'd get the idea that Antifa's under every rock and behind every tree. No, you would never find one if you wanted to see one, unless you're where they're at. Where are they at? They're in the cities. And they're not there all the time. They're there for certain events. They get bussed in. It's, you know, and it's a staged show more often than not. You know, there's nothing, what's the word, generic about it. Nothing, generic ain't the right word. Organic is the right word. There's nothing organic about that shit. It's all plotted and planned. And in the same fashion, Dave McGowan posits that what was going on in Laurel Canyon with that scene, you know, of the artists, the performing artists, was not organic either, because they were all coming, not all, but most, some, every band had somebody, if not a couple somebodies, that somehow had connections to the military industrial complex and or military intelligence or CIA, right? It's just all these uncanny connections. Jim Morrison, again, for example. And this is known, you know, I knew this as a junior high kid. His father was captain of a ship, and he became admiral eventually. But he was on the ship in the Gulf of Tonkin that, like, set off our involvement in Vietnam. He was the guy over there. And his son happened to be a rock star of prominence in Laurel Canyon, right? There's obvious sensibility to the logic involved, but you can't really nail it down for sure, for certain. You know, somebody involved has to step up and say that's exactly what was going on. And, you know, David McGowan's theories do not seem, as far as I've seen, to include anything like that. In fact, everybody's notion is that's all a bunch of fucking hooey. It's full of shit, you know? But it's very interesting to consider. They had things. You know, like, Laurel Canyon was weird. They had, you know, Lookout Mountain was a military base in the middle, like, on that, on the mountaintop inside Laurel Canyon area in the Hollywood Hills. They had a movie studio for the military in there, which is very strange, you know? I've seen where people suggest the idea, like, we've never landed on the moon, which is another David McGowan theory, right? The actual moonwalk never really happened, that it was actually a movie production, a film production, and that production was probably done at Lookout Mountain. Interesting shit to consider, but it's, you know, quote unquote conspiracy theory stuff, all involved with the happenings in Laurel Canyon at the time. And hey, and part of the happenings is even like the Charles Manson family, right? They were in and amongst those crowds of people. Charlie Manson was an aspiring rock star himself, and he was very good friends with the Beach Boys. You know, he actually, like, stayed at their house and shit. They were trying to produce an album for him. And, you know, if you know about the Manson family, the murders that happened, it wasn't right there in Laurel Canyon. It was, like, the next canyon, or was it Benedict Canyon or something like that? But he was part of that whole scene, too. And I mentioned the Wonderland murders. They came way later on. It was really outside of the scope of all this rock star and intelligence stuff. It was more of like a drug and sex and weird shit thing. I don't really know the whole story behind that, but, you know, these are the things that add up to make Laurel Canyon kind of a really kind of freaky, creepy place. And when you consider that my limo driver, my limo van driver, just refused to take us up there, these are the reasons why. He probably knew a lot more about that stuff than I did back then. Back then, I didn't know half of that shit, right? And Wonderland was kind of hot at the time. It hadn't been much earlier than 1986. I don't know exactly when it happened. I think it was the 80s, though. It's just a fucked up place to be. You know, and fucked up, yeah, there'll be fucked up things like, you know, drugs and sex and all that. You know, John Phillips, right? The Mamas and the Papas. One of the Papas of the Mamas and the Papas, right? Dude turned out to be like a real fucking weirdo. Even, you know, at the beginning of the Mamas and the Papas, early in the 60s, you know, he had hooked up. He was married, right? He was married and had children. One of the children was his famous daughter, the actress Mackenzie Phillips. We'll get into that in a minute, right? With this first wife of his. But he started having an affair with, like, a teenage girl. So there's a little bit of pedophilia right there. And, of course, it was also adultery, for those who care about morality. Most of you don't. Some do. This is who the guy, and he ended up divorcing his first wife, you know, and running off and being married with this teenage girl who was an aspiring model. Her name was Michelle Phillips. Who was also a singer in the Mamas and the Papas, and she was like the eye candy of the band, right? She was like the hippie girl with the golden hair that was parted down the middle and went all the way down her back, wearing all the tight hippie clothes and the bell bottoms and the mini skirts and all that shit, right? So that was her. She was iconic. You know, she was iconic of that whole 60s counterculture movement. But John Phillips, the husband, and father Mackenzie Phillips, and fathered, you know, him and Michelle fathered at least one daughter, who I'll probably mention in a moment. Also, this guy, I mean, you know, the signs of pedophilia with the young wife that he left his original marriage for, and then drug problems like crazy. Yeah, it was the 60s. They were all on drugs. But in the 70s, he was like, he was not making bank like he had. Like, the Mamas and the Papas, they only, like, produced albums for, like, a year and a half or something like that. There's a short amount of time where they had a bunch of hits, and their entire lives were built off of that moment in time, for the most part. Michelle Phillips ended up being an actor in the 80s, of note, you know. She was a prominent actor, and a huge television, like, nighttime soap or something like that. And then, but the rest, like, the other woman in the band was Cass Elliott. She was the big heavy one with the booming voice, great voice. She died very young, only a few years after the Mamas and the Papas. I think it's 1974. She died of something. You know, people joke that she choked on a ham sandwich, but I'm sure that wasn't the case. I don't really know. Probably drugs. Drugs. They're all over the place, right? There's John Phillips, though. The other guy, Denny Doherty. Now, I don't know what he did the rest of his life. They're all dead now except for Michelle Phillips. She may be dead for all I know at this point, but last I seen, she was still alive and kicking. The weird thing, though, going back to John Phillips, right? You see, like, he had that pedophilia streak in him going for those underage girls, right? And that's what was creepy about that song 1230. He wrote the lyrics, and he's talking about young girls coming through the canyon, right? And who are the young girls? There's all the high school girls. No doubt, right? No doubt. The same kind of girl that he married in his second marriage, you know. Some teenage girls. And he's all into that. And all the rock stars then. I really shouldn't be singling this guy out. You know, all the rock stars that us Generation X people listened through through the 60s, 70s, into the 80s. You know, the 60s and 70s was an era of that being the social norm. Where you had 25 and 30-year-old guys with 14, 15-year-old girls. Almost every band got some kind of involvement with it, you know? Hell, even before that, Elvis with his wife was, you know? You had, guy's name's escaping me. Shit. Oh, let's just move on past that. It's escaping me. I'm mixing things up. But like in the 70s, you know, Aerosmith, David Bowie, these bands, you know, they have stories to tell about like 15-year-old groupies and shit and involvements and families getting involved. Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page did that shit. God knows if the rest of them did, even by accident. But Jimmy Page had like an ongoing thing with a girl who was only 15 when he was in his, what was he, fucking 30 or more? It's just, and you know, I mentioned a couple of episodes back about burnout dating in the 80s, where I had an issue with guys who graduated high school and they were like in their 20s and they were competing with me for the girls who were my age and I was like 15 and 16. I hated that shit, but you know what? That was rock and roll culture. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and there was no boundaries for so many of these people, these dudes, to go back and be with teenage girls, right? As far as they're concerned, how does it go? If they're bleeding, they're breeding. Something like that. And to me, no, not so much. I think of it differently than that. But that's kind of how the culture was. And, you know, John Phillips exemplified that early on with his marriage to Michelle Phillips, which, you know, by the numbers, if you're an adult at 18, she was pedophilia, I guess you'd say. But weirder than that, right, the daughter that came out of his first marriage that I mentioned before, the actress Mackenzie Phillips, now she had drug problems and issues of her own all through her life. I think she's still alive. I don't know for a fact. But you know, she like did all these television interviews and wrote a book, like all this inside dirty laundry stuff involving her father. And it turned out like he had a incestuous relationship with her while she was a teenage girl, right? Maybe younger than that. I don't really know how far that back that goes. This is more pedophilia, and now you add the incest on top of it. Really fucking weird stuff in that family, in the family in that Laurel Canyon, all the shit that gone on over there. Mackenzie Phillips, like, she came to fame from one of those Norman Lear sitcom productions of the 70s, which I fucking hate them too, you know? I hate them too. That's all the, like, the 70s social justice warrior, hokey fucking obvious, like, poking at society, trying to change the way. I don't even know how to explain it. It's just so distasteful to me. You know, just, they would draw up all these situations. It's a situation comedy. And these comedy, you know, this guy's production, whatever, you know, Archie Bunker and all these fucking shows that he did. He was like the maven of sitcoms in the 70s. And they all kind of had that same tone to them where they were pointing out social issues using the characters in his stories, you know, shit happening in the families and, you know, racist this and whatever, just whatever social justice warriors are into now, they are into then. And it was just hokey. It was just like such a obvious pandering to that sort of thing. I don't know who the fuck it was appealing to or anything like that. You know, we had it on TV in the 70s. I may have mentioned this before. You had like 6-7 channels basically to listen to in your metropolitan area or watch, you know, not listen to. You could listen to it if you turn your head the other way. But you didn't have a whole lot of options. So whatever they put on TV, you just kind of had to get agreeable with if you wanted to be entertained in that manner, or else, fuck it, walk away. So we all seen these shows, and, you know, there's a part of me that has, like, a fond memory of it all. Like, One Day at a Time is what I'm talking about now. Like, I remember One Day at a Time, sort of with fondness. I call myself Dwayne Schneider of post-Arlen, Texas. Dwayne Schneider was the building superintendent and apartment building that this single mother and her family lived in. What was it, Indianapolis? And it was One Day at a Time, right? So Dwayne Schneider is from this One Day at a Time show that I'm talking about. But, like, to go back and watch clips of it, it's like, oh, my God, this is fucking horrible, you know? I hate it. I absolutely hate it. And it goes that way for every Norman Lear sitcom production from back in that era. I just cannot stand that pointed, obvious crap. It was like, opposite of that, right? You have, like, Sanford and Son, which wasn't a production of this guy. Sanford and Son was just about the characters and the interaction between the characters. It wasn't, like, focused on redirecting your social inclinations and changing the kind of person you were, making you aware of things that you may not have been aware of, you know? No. I mean, Fred G. Sanford poked fun, and Grady poked fun at the machinations of society, but really it was just all about character interaction, and it was the funniest fucking thing. It was about who they were as characters. It's great. Great entertainment. I love Sanford and Son, but I hate all this Norman Lear crap, and One Day at a Time is one of those things. I can't watch it. I can't watch it. But Dwayne Schneider, he's kind of iconic, you know? He's kind of like the, how do you put it? Sort of like the bartender psychologist that so many TV shows have. Just like that one guy you can kind of go to get advice. Remember Tim the Tool Man, Tim Allen, had his neighbor that you never saw his face over the fence. Tim Allen would always express his problems to the guy. He was like that bartender dude. Well, Schneider was like the bartender dude of One Day at a Time. But not actually bartenders, right? They're just somebody like you could put a tear in your beer and talk to and get some kind of sage provincial advice. You know, from somebody who is not a trained professional, you know. Dwayne Schneider. There was a, and I haven't seen it yet. I didn't even know it was happening. There was some kind of article or video that I stumbled on somewhere along the way in the past year or two that said that they did a One Day at a Time reboot. Right? They took that original show and they kind of just redid it. They used some of the same characters. They changed out some. They took some of the same characters and made them completely different. Like somebody who was white became Chinese or just something like that because they're trying to like make this racial emphasis shit, what social justice warriors always do, right? First and foremost, it's about race, then you get into gender identity issues and whatever, you know? Anything to destroy the family unit, it's all good, right? But there was some kind of reboot that was like that, and it just seemed like it was way out there, and I don't even want to see it, right? But it's there. One Day at a Time. You know what One Day at a Time comes from? It's an Alcoholics Anonymous slogan, right? One Day at a Time. What is that about? Like when you're new, like when you quit drinking and drugs, right? When you quit that shit. The first thing that you're confronted with is this idea that you can never drink another beer again as long as you live. And now the battle begins. And that's what it looks like. It's imposing. It's daunting. How the fuck am I going to go a year or 5 years, or 10 years, or 50 years, without ever having a beer? And you go into the war with that mindset, where One Day at a Time does is, it chops the monster down, and keeps everything present. You just gotta make it through this day, right? If you make it through this day, you wake up tomorrow, and then you just got to make it through that day. And it's just one day at a time. And eventually you'll be able to look back. If you succeed one day at a time, years will have gone by. I am 34 years, actually 34 and a half years, clean and sober, one day at a time. I don't plan my attack against the devils of liquor and narcotics by how I'm going to approach it for the year. It's just, I only have today, right? I only have today. This is all I've got to win. And that concept actually comes from the Holy Bible, right? Jesus is talking about worrying. What's it? Matthew 6, verse 34, right? I'm going to go pull out my app. I got my Blue Letter Bible app. Really handy for all you people that want to peruse the Bible. This is the King James version of it. And they can change the versions. Maybe I'll do that just for the fun so you can see how different versions can be. In verse 33, going up a little bit earlier for a little bit of context, not complete. But it's Jesus speaking, right? Jesus Christ is speaking. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. And now the next verse. Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Now that's kind of old English stuff. And that can be difficult for some people. If I change the translation, here's a New Living Translation, which is more contemporary and only like junior high level English, I think. I'll go down to the same verses I just read and reread them in this manner, right? In verse 33, chapter 6 of the Gospel of Matthew. Seek the kingdom of God above all else and live righteously, and he will give you everything you need. So don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will bring its own worries. Today's trouble is enough for today, right? So in plain English, it's about worry. It's about compacting worries and keeping the focus present, you know. What is on the plate to handle at this moment? Handle that. Let tomorrow be tomorrow. And when you get there, if you get there, you deal with it again, compartmentalized in a smaller snapshot of time that isn't so imposing. And as we win these days, we will accrue a whole lot of time and victory in little chunks, right? So the concept actually comes from Holy Scripture. And it was brought into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it became the thing. There's so many slogans in AA, but that is like the primary slogan that everybody knows is AA stuff. It may be the reason that Norman Lear's production team actually chose that, you know, because of the familiarity of the phrase. Who knows? I don't know. I don't really care to know. It's just something that crossed my mind. But then as I read that scripture, you could see the whole premise is in the idea about worrying about like what you don't have, what you're going to lose potentially, right? Don't worry. Don't worry. Don't worry. This is what Jesus is saying. If you just mind your place in the kingdom of God and you worry about yourself developing into a righteous, you know, holy human being, God will take care of all the rest of the stuff. I found this to be true personally. Yeah, it's not outlandish for Jesus to say. It was actually very sage advice and very practical, workable, and actual, you know, in my life for sure, right? Put that worry away. Let God handle it. God's the great provider. No different than your father will provide for you, you know, if you have a good, healthy father and a good, healthy family, right? God is amongst other things, your father. And part of that role is as provider. He provides. You don't have to worry about it. I got more shit than I know what to do with, right? I complain about this job, and I know I consider myself and my wife as quote-unquote working poor. I've got all kind, anything I ever want, it seems, I got. Or I'm in position to get. You know, there's a couple of big things out there. Like, I want to get out of the city and move out into the country again. Should the time avail itself, I'll have what I need. And if that's where God needs me to be, or will allow me to be, I'm gone. I'm going, you know. But I'm already starting to, like, line up the ducks and see the possibilities. In spite of everything, it is kind of in reach, right? I got plenty. I got plenty, and I more or less live that way. Just this day now. Tomorrow, the day after that, the day after that. Keep it in these kind of smallish increments and just keep winning the days, right? You keep winning the days, and then you accrue and accumulate things. And like I said, I got more than I fucking need, you know? But, you know, we might choose, on the other hand, to worry. We might not want to have anything to do with the ways of God. We don't really care about the wisdom of Jesus Christ. You know, I use this phrase, and it's nothing I made up. Stress puppy, right? I see it at work. The people got the bowl of candy, and they just sit there at the computer, and they just jamming themselves full of sugar power to just keep on going and fighting with the stress, and, you know, they're moving around with high tension and shit like that, right? You could live on worry, right? That could be like your driving force. That could be like the undercurrents of your existence, the power of worry. And I know a lot of people do. You know, there's this saying, this fear porn, right? Fear porn. The idea that, you know, you could look at the news, and the news will just give you something else to be afraid of. You know, the end of the world is coming, and it's coming from this direction in this manner. So here you go, be terrified, you know, be terrified. And then you're like, you live on that. It's like the thrill of a horror movie, except it's reality. And you just go from fear to fear, worry to worry. And it's like the energy that drives you in your life. And there's no peace in that. But so many people are kind of going by that. And, you know, that's the foundational driving energy of your existence. You respond to that in kind by gluttony and drug abuse and alcohol abuse and having to go to psychologists and psychiatrists and taking psychotropic medication and all the stuff that just kind of pollutes you and just drives you further and further away from all that is good and holy in the world. Sad but true, right? But yeah, fear porn. It's like if you watch the news, take in the news by whatever means, you know, whatever interface, whatever medium, on a daily basis or multiple times a day, it's just like one, what, bad thing after another, and it's often scary, and it's often intimidating, and it just works on your fears, and it frazzles your nerves, and, you know, we live in this cloud of shit that's happening in Washington, D.C. It's nowhere near us, and it has nothing to do with us, really. Might have an impact, a reverberation across time eventually. Yeah, perhaps. But if we're hanging on it hour to hour, as we're able to do now in the information age, and the smartphones and everything, and social media, you know, every little thing that happens, every little burp that happens on a national and international level can be horrifying, and we just kind of live to that horrifying story and to the next one and to the next one, like Tarzan swinging through a jungle. It's fucked up. But yeah, fear porn. Well, the idea of fear porn is that it's like pornography. Like, you get addicted to it, you get obsessed with it. It ruins your life, you know, everything that porn does, except rather than it being about sexual perversion, it's about some kind of odd addiction to being afraid. You know, whatever kind of biochemical, physiological response our bodies have to fear is something that we can junkie on, you know. and Jones without. Fucked up. And, I'm not on the other side of the story. I go, you're talking about John Lennon, right? He was like the figurehead for peace, you know, no more war, end the war, war is over. I think of peace, I think of it more as like a very personal thing. Like, I have my little realm of tranquility in spite of everything else going on in this fucked up world, right? And that peace for me is the peace of Jesus Christ, you know, that I pray for myself daily and for other people daily also. I live in that serenity. That's the AA word for it, right? The serenity that comes from what? Faith, right? Faith is the opposite of fear. You could live your life in the strife of fear continually, and whatever energy you derive from that, and it makes you insane. And it makes you need to reach out for all kinds of other things to patch up your little insanities and make you even more insane, right? Drugs, for example, medications, for example. But faith, on the other hand, my faith in Christ is a powerful enough entity where I completely disassociate myself from all of the other stuff. How many things did I take, how much shit did I put in my body in an effort to find peace and happiness in my life when I was a teenager? To no avail. All it did was create a monstrous nightmare. It just got worse and worse and uglier as time went by. And I didn't find no peace until I came to faith. Now the basis of my existence, my natural undercurrent, my baseline mood and attitude is serenity, tranquility, peace. I'm a lot different in that regard than I used to be. Peace was something I had to search for. Now it's something I got all the time. And if I don't got it, something's fucked up. So I automatically know if I'm outside of peace, I done did something wrong, you know, and I got to correct things. Makes life very easy to deal with, you know. If I have a confrontation with somebody, for example, and I just can't seem to shake it off of my head, it's very easy for me to recognize that I did or said something wrong, inappropriate, untimely, whatever, and I need to go back to that person and make it right. And then I do, and everything gets ironed out, and then there's all kinds of peace again. And it's so easy that way, compared to when the lunacy of being on drugs all the time and shit like I always had been before. It's fucked up. Fear versus faith. You know, like, I used to preach that, right? On a weekly basis. I mentioned before, I did a Saturday morning coffee talk, Facebook Live, in like the heart of the COVID era, at the beginning of the first year plus another month or so. Every Saturday, religiously, I'd go out there with a guitar and I'd play a couple of songs, and then I'd talk some shit between the songs, and then I would break the Bible out and I would literally preach to who? My friends and family, right? It was directed at that. And people would check in and hang out, and it was really good, you know? It was at the behest of my my wife's nephew. My nephew, he thought it would be a good idea if I just got up there and just started preaching the word on social media, and I gave it a whirl for a while, and it was a good and memorable thing. And I did talk frequently in the COVID era about this fear versus faith, because so many people were afraid. And as I sit here right now, right next to me, out my window, is a fucking COVID mask sitting on the ground, right? We're post-COVID. I can't find anybody who's had it in the past few months. That's how it is here in DFW, you know? Big major city, right? Plunked down in the middle of it all. And I don't know anybody. I haven't heard of anybody having it anytime recently. You don't have all these counts and all this data and all this shit happening like it used to be. But when it first happened, nobody seemed to know exactly what the fuck was going on. People were very afraid. I say this COVID mask now because there's still people walking around with these fucking masks on. Because they're what? Still afraid. They're afraid. They're living in fear. See, I don't live in fear because of my faith. The faith wipes the fear out. My faith is what? I could die right now And I'm in a win-win situation. Whether I live or whether I die, I get to live. The world sucks. I'd actually be better off dead, you know? But I get to be here doing the work that God has for me to do. And all the attaboys that eventually will come with that. While he provides for me as a father does, like I explained earlier, it's all good. You know, it might be dismal, might be ugly. There might be a lot of fucked up shit happening, not too far away, you know. All these stories I told about Laurel Canyon, you know, the shit happens in the world. People are fucked up. And, I was trying to encourage people to this faith, to get outside of their fears, their selfishness, come to this faith, put yourself in this win-win situation, right? So that was kind of like my version of like a COVID lockdown podcast. I never called it a podcast, but I guess that's exactly really what it was. And you know, the great emphasis of it was the faith in Christ overcomes the fear of COVID. And so much, you know, fear of COVID even still happens long after the fact. Let the mask on the ground next to me. There's going to be other ones out there in the parking lot somewhere. There's people walking around, you know, wearing their mask. We got a guy who wears a mask and he wears like a fucking welder's helmet over the mask, you know. And he's been doing this for a couple of years now. It's like, what the fuck? I cannot understand it. I just cannot. I was never that way. I was just never that person. I never bought into all this shit. I never had any reason to be afraid of it. If I'm going to catch a virus and die, I'm going to catch a virus and die. That's how it's supposed to be. I'm good with that. Because I believe in a hereafter. I don't just talk that talk. I literally believe in it. I've almost died before. At the heart attack. When I come to in the morning and I'm still alive, I was a little bit disappointed. That was a long time ago. I was fairly early in my faith back then, you know. I'm seasoned in the faith now. But, you know, it's just speaking of COVID lockdown podcasts, right? I accidentally worked my way into that kind of effort. In that sort of genre during the COVID era, mine was not out of desperate need, right? I wasn't making money at it or anything like that. I was just trying to help the people who I care about to understand and see things differently and not be caught up in all this TV bullshit. I mean, I just turn off the fucking TV, turn the fucking TV off, get away from that crap, and just focus on what's in front of you right here, you know? And don't be afraid. You got Christ. It's a win-win situation, you know? That was my message for a year. But other people, like, you had the actual podcast during the COVID lockdown, right? People were famous, right? Famous people, but they weren't entertainers and shit, whether they're actors, whether they're musicians. Like, we've been talking about actors and musicians all the way through here. They had no more means. Everybody, all these kind of people were out of work. Bars were shut down. Or they were very limited, you know. Who was going to travel through COVID, basically, city to city and spread the shit around? And no, they were shut down. So it's like my favorite musicians, like Reverend Horton Heat, for example. They would do a podcast and they would play music, maybe talk about old stories. And they were auctioning off like all their old equipment and everything, you know. Junior Brown, him and his wife would get up and they would play songs and they would have like some kind of digital way to like donate money to them, things like that, maybe sell their records or whatever. It was really sad to see these great people who I have met, you know, be stuck in a situation like that. But it wasn't just the musicians, it was actors and actresses too. And here's the thing, I stumbled on it. I don't know how I got there. I don't know of the person really, but it was the birth child, the daughter of this John Phillips, and Michelle Phillips, right? They had at least one kid together, and this one was a daughter that they named China, right? China. And she was doing a podcast. I watched a couple of episodes of it because it was just, to me, it was weird at the time. I wasn't cognizant that this was really going on, that like Hollywood actors were out there out of work and they were just doing like podcasts in their house and showing you their day-to-day life, you know, all their stuff. And there was one of them that I watched with this China Phillips where her mother Michelle was in it, and then Michelle, now she was like the beauty icon as a, you know, teenager slash early 20 year old, the hippie girl in the 60s, and then she was the mature icon of beauty in the 80s, like as late 30s, early 40s, right? More, a little bit more matronly, but still a beautiful person, beautiful to look at, right? So she had always been like the symbol, an icon of the cultural icon of beauty through all these years. And now here she is, like in her 70s, no makeup, all dressed frumpy, not giving a shit, you know, and just kind of being herself. It's like an old woman. It was, I'm not going to say it was funny. I'm not going to say it was anything. It was just kind of interesting because these people have real lives, right? And like this China Phillips, she would, you know, had a husband and they would talk. She's got it all going like on video, and she'd walk down the street doing her exercise in the neighborhood up in the Hollywood Hills, I guess it was, you know, talking about Laurel Canyon and everything like that. And after a couple episodes of it, it was just really weird. And in my estimation, she's a really weird person, right? There was, what was that? They did music, right? Her and one of the Beach Boys' daughters, Wilson Phillips is what they called it. I think it was in the 80s, maybe early 90s. They made some albums. There was one song. I have no idea. I can't remember. But I kind of remember seeing it like on videos. Maybe it was during Beavis and Butthead and they were panning it or something like that. I don't know. I'm not making really an assessment about the music. I just don't know the music, but it was like this collaboration between one of the daughters of the Beach Boys and a daughter of, actually, was it two daughters of the Beach Boys? I think it was three girls, but it was like daughter or daughters of the Beach Boys and daughter or daughters of, Mamas and Papas collaborating. So it was like the next generation, like Star Trek, the next generation, right? The next generation of all these Laurel Canyon brats. Is that appropriate? I don't know. I don't have to be appropriate. Just telling it. But yeah, these podcast videos, like in the house, they just really, after the initial fascination of seeing famous people living their lives, faded away. Then the reality of it is like, wow, these people are kind of out there and fucked up. I'm doing podcasts now, and I don't know that I'm that out there and that fucked up. I may be, you know. I'm certainly going to be different than a lot of people who ever listen to this. And, you know, maybe it just takes a real weird kind of person to do podcasting. To talk about their lives and put out their thoughts, to air them out, you know. But that was more, it was closer to the lines of just like dirty laundry. The context of it wasn't really meaningful. It was just like the day-to-day drudgery of rich and famous people. I don't know. But there you go. I mean, fucking A. One day at a time. One day of their time. One day of all kinds of time. I'm going to leave it with that. That's a whole lot of stuff. Even my mind is kind of spinning. So, moving on. Adios.
Thank you for tuning into Post Harlan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.